If after today's topic you are interested for some more airway education, you should be checking out the Intensive Care Academy. That's our online school over at ICU101.com, where you'll find a wide variety of video lessons you can watch at your own pace, ranging from the most basic of topics to the most advanced. And we just finished building out our airway module. And for you loyal listeners, we are doing a quick sale, good until March 15th, 2025. If you put in the code FEB25, F-E-B-2-5, you'll be getting a 10% discount for new subscriptions. Check it out. ICU101.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm Brian Bowling, and with me, as always, is Brandon Odo.
Milu.
So we've done a lot of airway talks, I think. Airway is something that Brandon and I are both kind of interested in. I know not everybody manages airways, but it is a big part of care in the ICU. But we've never really tackled specifically the difficult airway and what to do. And specifically, we want to look at some approaches, including the vortex approach. And so we thought, well, who better to talk about the vortex approach than the guy who made it up? Dr. Nick Crimes is a consultant anesthesiologist at Monash Medical Center down in Melbourne, Australia. And he is the creator of the vortex approach to airway management and the co-founder of the Australian and New Zealand Safe Airway Society. So welcome to the podcast, Nick.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Nick, I want to talk about the specific approach to airway management, kind of the model or algorithm that you developed. But just to be a little more general to start out, what's your mindset or the way that you think about thinking about the airway? Because I think for most people who are trained to address an airway, certainly in an ill patient, they start by focusing on details, on specific techniques and how you approach those, which of course is essential. But the idea of thinking about it on a larger scale and having, quote, an approach or an algorithm or a model for it, whether it's individual to them or something that's more standardized, is something that I don't even think people see the utility of for some time. And then how you go about building that is a whole nother matter. So what's your general take on this? And obviously, I'm sure it's one that informed the one that you yourself put together.
Yeah, look, I think the way the vortex came up was really because I think the answer to your question really stems from what are you using that approach for? And I think, you know, looking at airway catastrophes, the sort of very detailed algorithms, or, you know, people have checklists and very strict plans of what to do. The way that I think you naturally respond to something going wrong is to say, oh, this went wrong, so let's just write down how to do it right. And so they write in very detailed specifics, you do this and you do your jaw thrust and you blah, 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 and you go through. The problem with those sort of detailed approaches, and that's the way that the guidelines come out and the algorithms that come out with the guidelines sort of approach things in a very detailed way. The problem with that and the way I sort of got to the vortex was, when you look at those things, I would look at them and think that's great, but in real time, when you're stressed in an emergency, how do you access all that information? Because if you look at what goes wrong in airway emergencies, it's not usually that people don't know what to do or have the skills to do it. It's usually they just don't remember to do it. So it's a difference between what I call a foundation tool that educates you in how to approach the airway and an implementation tool or a cognitive aid, which is what the vortex is, which prompts you to remember to do the broad aspects of those things in real time in an emergency. Because when you look at airway disasters, when things go hideously wrong, it's because people, you know, they don't remember to attempt a supraglottic airway, or they don't move to neck rescue, to cutting the neck. Those sort of simple things get overlooked. And so when I was looking at airway algorithms, I originally started with the ASA algorithm, which is, you know, it's technically, it makes sense, but it's a very complicated thing to look at, and you can't really, there's no way you could refer to it in real time. So when the Difficult Airway Society came out with their first algorithm, I think in about 2005, which was much more simple with the sort of plan A, B, C, D way that we all talk about today, I still looked at it and I said, are you supposed to look at this beforehand, or are you supposed to look at it in the moment? Because it looks too complicated to use in the moment. Now, I do a lot of simulation training, so I would see people in simulation and they would not be able to recall the algorithm. You can talk to them about, and it's not just airway, it's everything, every sort of crisis. You can talk to people about what they will do before they go into the crisis. And you can talk to them after they go into crisis. And at both of those points, they'll be able to tell you what they should do. But in there, they just don't do it. So the sort of broad approach you're talking about with the Vortex was really designed to help people implement stuff they already knew, whereas the algorithms are trying to tell you, give you information to sort of describe to you how you should manage it. The Vortex assumes you already know how to manage it. It just reminds you what the options are. It's really just a prompt. And then on the website, there's a whole lot of background information to flesh that out, which is sort of more foundation material. But the actual sort of circular graphic that people know, for people who know the Vortex, is really designed to prompt you in real time. It's not, and the idea is that, you know, it gives you some very simple rules that are sort of common to airway algorithms. Don't have more than three attempts. Try all the three upper airway lifelines before you cut the neck, etc. But beyond those sort of very broad boundaries, it pretty much assumes you know how to make a judgment. So is there an algorithm will say do this, then do that? The Vortex specifically doesn't tell you anything about what the sequence should be or which optimizations you would implement. It just reminds you, have you tried manipulations? Have you tried using an adjunct? And it accepts that it's designed for people who've already been trained to manage an airway, just to remind them to do things. Because as I say, when I've in real life, in reading cases, in watching simulations, that was my observation. People know what to do, but they don't remember to do it.
So it sounds like your impression, and I'm sure this is based on reviewing a lot of practical cases and those that have been reported in the literature, is that a lot of failed airways and airway catastrophes and potentially avoidable ones, the most common error to make was not technical or granular and very detailed, but sort of obvious things, people omitting or just failing to do something that on a good day outside of that moment, they easily could have told you that was necessary. It was obvious. It would be like if you're driving a car and it didn't occur to someone to press the brake or something if they were going too fast, on that sort of level. So you're like, what people need, and not necessarily replacing other tools or algorithms, but kind of to avoid most of these problems, is just basically a way to remind people of those things.
That's exactly right. And what you said there is really crucial, is that I'm always very keen to emphasize that the Vortex is an adjunct, not an alternative to the other algorithms. It's designed, it doesn't matter whether you use the ASA algorithm or the Difficult Airway Society algorithm, or you've got your own local institution's algorithm, or you've made up something for yourself that works for you. It doesn't matter what you use. What the Vortex provides is a way for you to be prompted to make sure you follow it, because it's so flexible in the way you can use it. The sequence you can implement anything is sort of infinite. So because of that, it works with any underlying structure to just prompt you, to remind you. And the reasons that people, you know, when we say there are people forget, it's more complicated than forgetting, obviously. There's omissions and there's fixations and there's a whole lot of human behavior related things and cognitive biases that come into that. And it's really, the Vortex is designed to just put things in front of you to try and overcome those tunnels we tend to go down, whether they're fixating on something or bypassing something.
So if someone has sort of sat down by themselves or with their team and made decisions like, well, I'm strongest with hyperangulated video laryngoscopy, so that's my general first line technique, and usually my backup might be a regular geometry blade with a bougie or something. That's sort of their own thing, but that is does not contradict anything you're saying. You think the Vortex mindset is flexible enough that it should apply essentially to everyone. I mean, I don't know if there's some niche case where this is not relevant, but...
Yeah, no, I think it applies to everything. And really, the underlying sort of principle of the Vortex is having a best effort at each of, you know, we call the sort of three upper airway lifelines of face mask, supraglottic airway, tracheal tube. You know, they're the three ways you can access the airway from above. And if your best effort at each of those doesn't work, then you've got to move to neck rescue. And that's really the fundamental premise. And whereas the algorithms sort of describe it, plan A is I'm going to do this and this and this, plan B is going to do this and this and this, the Vortex thinks about more in terms of your best effort. Before I abandon that lifeline, what are the things I would have wanted to have implemented to say that was my best effort? So not just an optimized single attempt, but the cumulative impact of up to three attempts. What are the things that within those three attempts I need to have done to say I've had my best effort? And then, as I said, those overall sort of guardrails rules of you can only have three attempts at each lifeline dictate that you've got to somehow divide those into three attempts. But one of the problems with the algorithm plan A, B, C type model is it doesn't really work terribly well in real time, because when you say I'm gonna, you know, plan A is I'm gonna have a look with the MacBlade video laryngoscope, and you know, and then if that doesn't work, plan B is I'm gonna try and face mask ventilate. Now, what you're next at, or even not plan A, plan B, because they might say my first attempt is gonna be with MacBlade video laryngoscope, and then I'm gonna have an attempt at face mask. Now, what you do after that will very much depend on that attempt at face mask. So if your laryngoscopy is unsuccessful and then you attempt face mask ventilation, if face mask ventilation is successful, you might very well just go back to laryngoscopy and have another attempt, and you've got time to get me the hyperangulated blade and whatever. But if that face mask attempt is not successful and the oxygen saturations are now falling, then the next thing you probably should do is stick in a supraglottic airway. So what you get into is this multiverse of parallel timelines, is that people talk about my first attempt will be this, my second attempt will be this, but pretty soon when they go to implement it, that doesn't work anymore because your next attempt is dependent on what you found on the preceding attempt.
You can't plan for anything.
And so you can't really play that way in real life. It works in a very static setting, but it's something that doesn't, that people haven't sort of recognized doesn't play out in real time. Whereas the Vortex just says, you know, instead of describing I'm going to do this and this and this, what you would brief your team on, because you can use the Vortex for planning as well, is to say, look, my best effort at face mask ventilation is going to be two hands with a vice grip, an oropharyngeal airway, a nasopharyngeal airway in the sniffing position, blah, blah, blah. And so by the end of three attempts, I want you to prompt me to make sure we've done all those things within the three attempts. So if I seem to be missing out on those, or I'm getting to my third attempt, there's things we haven't done, or we haven't given, you know, fully paralyzed would inevitably be one of those things. You know, if I'm getting to my third attempt and we haven't given muscle relaxant in an anesthetic setting where we often start without muscle relaxant, because our plan is to use a supraglottic airway for the case, things like that get overlooked. One of the problems with you know, anesthetics is probably more complicated in some ways because we often start without a lot of optimizations in place. Our plan is not to put in a tracheal tube. Our plan is not to paralyze. And so what you see happen is that as things unfurl, the operator will give, you know, might have their attempts at supraglottic airway and face mask ventilation, and then they'll move to intubation and they'll give muscle relaxant to intubate, but they don't go back and reattempt face mask and supraglottic airway with muscle relaxant on board. So they've never had a best effort of those, because to have a best effort at any upper airway lifeline, you have to have tried it in the presence of full muscle relaxation, because that makes a profound difference to the likelihood of success. And so they don't think to go back and necessarily, they think, oh, we tried those things, they didn't work, and they don't go back and do them plus muscle relaxation. And so they don't have a best effort and they move they move forwards. And the case may turn out fine, but, you know, it may progress doing much more invasive sort of neck rescue airway that that was unnecessary. Or it may progress to disaster. And, you know, the thing you don't want to do is being lying in bed thinking, oh, God, I never tried to face mask ventilate after they were paralyzed. And if you look, you're probably familiar with the Elaine Bromley case that happened in the UK. Do you know that case? So that's largely billed as failure to move to neck rescue, you know, fixation on an upper airway and failure to move to neck rescue. And there's no doubt that that's what happened. But if you look at that case, again, an anesthetic case, they never attempted supraglottic airway in the presence of muscle relaxation. And so I think that the underlying problem there was actually failure to have a best effort, failure to have a structured approach there for a whole lot of understandable reasons. I'm not criticizing that team, but that's the end result. And certainly if they can't think of what to do, you know, if you can't remember anything else to do, then you do need to move on to neck rescue. I'm not saying that wouldn't have been necessary, but there are ways to resolve that case that weren't. That weren't neck rescue, because if you look at the whole case at about, I can't remember the exact time, but the whole thing goes for sort of half an hour, but at about 20 minutes, they put in a intubating laryngeal mask and that went in and they could ventilate with it. But that was after muscle relaxation, but that was the first time they'd attempted supraglottic airway after having administered muscle relaxation. So all these things happen where they, you know, things get lost and get moved out of sequence. And so that problem of the sort of multiverse of airway options, when you plan a sort of rigid, I'm going to do this on my first attempt, this on my second attempt, it just doesn't work, because when something goes wrong, something unexpected has happened. And those things may work, you know, in an emergency medicine or an ICU setting where you're just intubating, it probably works more often. But if you look down and on your first attempt at laryngoscopy, you unexpectedly see a big tumor that's obstructing the cords, well, that can change it. Your next attempt should be to do nothing at all. It should be to face mask ventilate and get someone else. And, you know, you don't want to jab this big friable lesion that you've suddenly noticed. If you can mask ventilate well, you just stop there. But that inevitably is not going to be part of their plan before they go to sleep. You know, if I can't get the tube in, I'm just going to face mask ventilate and call for help, because the whole game has changed. So you're getting new information about, you know, not just about pathology, but about, you know, in general, you're getting new information about your ability to ventilate or establish alveolar ventilation every time you do a maneuver or have another attempt. And so what the vortex does is allow you to not get locked into a rigid sequence of doing things, but rather it sets a goal that by the end of the three attempts, I want to have done all these things. And the order I do them in may change depending on how things play out. So that's sort of the flexibility it gives. The other problem with the algorithms is they sort of assume that we're going to, you know, they'll sort of plan A is to intubate, plan B is to ventilate with a face mask, plan C is a supraglottic airway sort of thing. And that sort of assumes that we have all our attempts at intubation and then all attempts at face mask ventilation, all our attempts at supraglottic airway clustered together. But that's not the way we practice. You know, in real life, we will have a look with a laryngoscope, I can't see, I'll need another device, we'll go back and we'll face mask ventilate in between. And then if that doesn't work, we might go, and if that works, we go back to face mask. But if we go back to another attempted intubation. But if that doesn't work, we might move on to supraglottic airway, because at the moment we've got nothing that is working. That's the way we do things in real life, and that's the most efficient way to establish an airway, because it's you know, the literature shows that there's a sort of law of diminishing returns in having repeated attempts at the same lifeline when it's already shown itself to be challenging. So, you know, there's no doubt that if your initial attempt at face mask ventilation doesn't work, there are optimizations you can do to improve that. But the percentage of cases where the airway is established where it's not on the first attempt, it gets smaller each time. You pick up a small number. So once the initial attempt has shown itself more likely to be that it's challenging, then your subsequent attempts have become much more likely to be challenging. And some of them you'll sometimes with optimizations, you'll overcome the obstruction to the airway, and sometimes you won't. So investing in repeatedly doing, trying to, you know, legitimately optimize an existing airway lifeline that's already shown itself to be challenging is less likely to yield results than just changing to a first attempt at something that you haven't tried at all yet. Because whilst there are many factors in the airway that cause difficulty across all three lifelines, there are also factors that are quite specific to one. So it may be that whilst you can't get a view at laryngoscopy, face mask ventilation is completely straightforward. And so that idea of getting, you know, again, focusing on the idea is to ventilate, is not to get a bit of plastic in the trachea. And so that, you know, once you've sort of put the patient off to sleep and caused either potentially apnea or obstruction, the thing you want to do is restore alveolar ventilation as fast as possible. And so repeated attempts at the same thing might not be the best way to do that. So the algorithms sort of encourage a way that is artificial. It's not what we do. And they also they also lock you into this sort of law of diminishing returns, which is not the most efficient way to find a way to restore alveolar ventilation. They also lock you into a rigid, again, a rigid sequence, as I'm going to do face mask, then I'm going to do intubation, then face mask, then supraglottic airway, whatever it is. Whereas the circular nature of the vortex, because the three lifelines are arranged concentrically, it allows you to start with any of them and allows you to move between them in any order. Because yet another problem with the algorithms is they all assume that your primary intention is tracheal intubation, and yet in an anesthesiology setting, you know, the most common, you know, in the United States today, most patients undergoing airway management will be having a laryngeal mask placed. So, you know, for the most common indication for airway management in the world, there is no, or in the developed world, there is no algorithm to address that your primary intention is to place a supraglottic airway. They all assume your plan is to intubate. And again, Elaine Bromley is probably the most famous airway case in the world. And the primary case there was to, the primary intention there was to intubate. It was to place a supraglottic airway rather than intubate. And yet 20 years later, there is still no airway algorithm that is designed for that context. And so you can say, oh yeah, I'm just going to reverse the order of it and I'm going to do the supraglottic airway. I'm going to start with plan B or plan C or whatever it is. But, you know, that's the last thing you need in what is already a stressful and cognitively overloaded situation, is to try and run your algorithm backwards.
Okay, so we've kind of been gnawing around it, but take us through what the vortex approach looks like. This is kind of a visual thing, so I think most people would benefit from just go to the website. It'll come up on Google, but there's kind of a diagram involved. But to the extent that you can, kind of walk us through what this model looks like and how people can think about it.
Okay, so if you go to vortexapproach.org, you can bring up the picture, and it's a circle that basically the premise of the vortex is there are only three ways to establish an airway via the upper airway: face mask, supraglottic airway, tracheal tube. And if those things, if your best effort at those three things fails, then you need to perform neck rescue. And that's really the entire premise of it. And as I said, by arranging them on this sort of circular graphic, it allows you to sort of move between them, start with any of them, depending what your goal is, and move between them in any order. So that the three lifelines of face mask, supraglottic airway, and tracheal tube are around the outside, and neck rescue or front of neck airway is emergency front of neck airway is in the center. So that in two dimensions it's just a circle, and you could criticize it on that ground that it sort of depicts a fixation error in a way of just going around in a circle and you never get to the middle. But what that's supposed to depict, that circle is supposed to depict looking down into a funnel. So the idea is that the that as you move between circumferentially between those three options, you also move towards the center as you're descending into that funnel. And that funnel again is supposed to graphically depict that we talk about this idea of sort of cognitive imprinting or conceptual imprinting. That, you know, the narrowing of the funnel is depicting that there's less time and less options as you have as you fail to succeed at any of those lifelines. So you can sort of spiral down into that funnel, and you can move, as I said, you can move between the three options in any order you like, but each time you're moving more towards the center of the graphic as well, and more towards the inevitability of neck rescue if you're not successful. So not failure to have success at any of the lifelines moves you towards the center of the graphic. Conversely, if you succeed with any of your attempts, you move outwards into what we call the green zone. So around the perimeter of that circle, there's a green ring. And the green zone is the circumstance where you can confirm that you have adequate alveolar ventilation. And so on the basis of I've got a sustained capnography trace and I'm adequately maintaining saturations, that means I'm exchanging gas with the alveoli enough to maintain an adequate saturation. Not necessarily a normal saturation, but an adequate saturation that gives me the option to now sort of tap the brakes and talk to the team about what we're going to do next before we instrument the airway again. Because, again, as you'd be aware, a lot of airway disasters come from failure to come from just repeated attempts that traumatize the airway and make things worse without optimizing them. So that's really broadly it. The three options: if you're unsuccessful, you spiral towards the middle. If you're successful, you move to the outside and into the green zone. And I think there's also a green circle in the very middle, just to articulate or just to emphasize that if you do get to the point where you need to perform neck rescue, that also gets you the green zone. That you shouldn't be feel that you've failed in having to perform neck rescue. If you've done all the right things and that's just the situation you're in, then that is the path to making the patient safe and restoring alveolar oxygenation. I think that distinction between the blue central bits of the circle and the outer perimeter of green and the central dot of green is really important, because, and it's something that at the time the most airway algorithms, so the Vortex originally came out in about 2013, and at that stage airway algorithms told you what to do if things were unsuccessful, but I don't think there was any airway algorithm at that stage that told you what to do if something succeeded, something other than what was your intended endpoint. So obviously, if you want to put a tube in, the tube goes in, that's the end. You move on with your life. But none of the algorithms really address the situation where, what if I want to put a tube in but can't, and then I face mask ventilate and I can? No one sort of articulated, well, how do you exploit the opportunities of the green zone? How do you exploit the ability to adequately ventilate the patient? And I think that's really important, because the being able to ventilate in itself gives you a particular set of opportunities and obligations. Because if you look at airway disasters again, it's very, very rare. I'm sure it happens, but it's very rare that you put someone off to sleep, you push your induction agent, and at no place can you face mask ventilate with a supraglottic airway or intubate. There's just, you know, can't intubate, can't oxygenate de novo from the outset, and you never ventilated. Most airway disasters, if you read them, at some point they could ventilate. And then through repeated attempts, either through bad judgment or bad luck, the airway gets worse and they lose that ability to ventilate, and then it moves on to can't intubate, can't oxygenate. So often the airway operator is partly responsible, can feel responsible for causing the can't intubate, can't oxygenate situation, which adds to the sort of psychological burden of moving to that confronting intervention of neck rescue. So I think it's really important to recognize that when you know what to do when you can't ventilate is important, but what to do, having advice or stopping and thinking when you can ventilate, is just as important. To say, okay, well, we know repeated instrumentation, having too many attempts is a common theme in airway catastrophes. So while I can ventilate, before I screw this up by maybe sticking something down there and causing more bleeding and swelling, let's maybe get some more experienced staff. We've got time now. Get some more experienced staff, get some equipment ready, and think through, again, on the basis of now I've got a bit of information I didn't have before I put the patient off to sleep and had the preceding attempts. Now I'm going to think, what's the best thing to do next? How are we going to do it next? And what is the plan if that plan fails? So if you're going to say, well, next I would, you know, if that doesn't work, we're going to have a go with the hyperangulated blade. Well, have we actually got the hyperangulated blade here then? Have we put a stilet in the tube so we're not left in the middle of a, you know, if we lose the airway, we're not less setting things up. And again, for neck rescue, the idea of priming for neck rescue. So the emergency physicians talk a lot about the double setup. You know, when they're going off to sleep and they're really concerned, they'll get ready for an optimized attempt from above, but they'll also get someone poised to perform neck rescue from below. So they're ready to do both. That's sort of the extreme version of priming. But historically, the way we've viewed neck rescue is that it's been about, we've tended to view the optimization of the upper airway lifelines and the preparation for neck rescue, other than that double setup situation, we've viewed them as a sequential process, that we focus all our attention on optimizing the upper airway. And if that doesn't work, whether it best efforts is all of them or plan A, B, C, whatever it is, then we get to the point where we declare this is can't intubate, can't oxygenate, and then we switch all our attention to the lower airway, to the neck, and accessing that. What that means is that from the time you declare this is a can't intubate, can't oxygenate situation, there's inevitably a delay now, because you've got to get ready and you've got to get your equipment out and you've got to get psychologically prepared. And there's a lag between declaring it and actually being in a position just practically to implement it. A delay during which the patient is usually going to be hypoxic. So you're extending the period of hypoxemia for them. The idea of priming for neck rescue is that, you know, even if you don't get into the green zone, in an evolving airway emergency, that as things get worse, that you start to do the upper airway optimizations and preparation for neck rescue in parallel. So that as it becomes apparent that it's less and less likely that you're going to establish an airway from above, you start to get out the kit beforehand, and you open the kit and you feel the neck and you do everything except actually make a hole in the cricothyroid membrane. So that in the situation where you think, yeah, this is a can't intubate, can't oxygenate situation, you're now in a position to implement neck rescue with minimal latency and therefore expose the patient to less hypoxemia. So that can happen as a real-time process even with an obstructed airway, but in the green zone, it enables you to stop. Okay, so we're going to get ready for our next attempt at laryngoscopy and we're going to do these things. But if that doesn't work, we've already had best efforts at face mask and superglottic airway. This will complete our best effort at laryngoscopy. So if this doesn't work, our next step after that will be neck rescue. And so what I want you to do is get the kit out, feel the cricothyroid membrane, have the scalpel in your hand. Don't do it until I say, but that's the plan. And so you've done two things. So there's a practical preparation that can go on in the green zone, but there's also a psychological preparation, because another of the delays to neck rescue is just people getting their head around the fact that it needs to be done. But in that green zone moment, when the patient is safe, they haven't got a protected airway, but that's really the last of your concerns at that point. But you're able to ventilate them. You can now spend 10 minutes saying, let's get all that right. And does everyone understand that if this doesn't work, that's the right thing to do? Or does anyone want to challenge that? Is there anything we've missed? You know, you can think through all of those things. So those opportunities of the green zone are really important. And since the Vortex came out, I think the 2015 Difficult Airway Society guidelines acknowledged the utility of the vortex, and they've since, the Difficult Airway Society in subsequent guidelines, I think in 2018, they actually built the vortex into their critical care guideline. But the Difficult Airway Society then created this idea in their algorithm of the stop and think moment, which is sort of the equivalent of if you're in the green zone, you can stop and think. So I think that's added a whole dimension to, you know, it's the other side. Rather than it just being a failed airway algorithm, it's also a what happens when elements other than your target airway succeed.
The term neck rescue is probably not one that's familiar to a lot of people. The end of a lot of airway algorithms involves a cricothyrotomy. So I presume by the term neck rescue, you mean a surgical or a needle cricothyrotomy, or perhaps a tracheotomy if that's in someone's skill set, or you kind of, sounds like, don't care how someone gets into the neck to ventilate the lungs, but
that's exactly right, Brandon. It's a term where with the Vortex users and the other project I'm involved with, Puma, the Universal Airway Guidelines. It's an umbrella term for all of those things. I think one of the problems, again, another aspect of the vortex is this idea of what we call critical language, language that is clearly defined, mutually understood, and consistently used to avoid ambiguity in a high-pressure situation. And I think that there's, again, plenty of cases where someone has said, can you do a tracheostomy? And someone has then started getting out gauze and prep and spent a long, you know, getting access to the neck, you know, it can take 90 seconds or it can take 35 minutes, depending how you do it. And so what neck rescue is defined as a technique to access the airway through the front of the neck that is suitable for the time critical situation of complete upper airway or insurmountable upper airway obstruction. And, you know, without getting obsessed with, is it a tracheostomy or is cricothyrotomy? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. As long as you can do, you know, the preference is cricothyrotomy, but, you know, in a pediatric patient that, you know, in a neonate or a young pediatric patient, they don't have a cricothyroid space. So it's going to be a tracheotomy. So it's to get away from all the specifics again. As the vortex is supposed to be a sort of universal tool, it's just to say, you know, that's neck rescue. How you do it in your specific context for your patient group doesn't matter. I don't want to nail you to a particular anatomical thing or a particular technique. The other thing is to create language that's not intimidating. I think, you know, I've heard there's so many terms for this. There's, you know, people talk about infraglottic rescue. You know, you start talking about infraglottic rescue, it's technically right, but no one knows what you're talking about. The thing about neck rescue is, as you say, you haven't heard the term. I deliberately don't define it when I use it because I find if you use it in context, people as you did, they get it. I assume you mean this. And in fact, what I found is if I talk to people about it, they start using it. So, you know, the Difficult Airway Society created emergency front of neck airway, which, why front of neck? I don't know. It's not like anyone's going to go through the back. So really the useful bit of that is emergency neck airway. And the problem is that because emergency front of neck airway spells EFONA, you know, our natural tendency is to start speaking the acronym, which is incomprehensible to anyone who hasn't been initiated into it. So, you know, when I say neck rescue and you've never heard it, you can intuit what it means. If I say EFONA and you've never heard it, you know, and I've asked my anesthetic nurses in the operating room, if I said we need to do EFONA, what would I mean? And they said, I've got no idea. You know, that you can't take that risk that people don't understand what it is. The other problem is that the E, you know, EFONA is the time critical thing, the E, the emergency front of neck airway. But because we want to shorten things, people start just talking about FONA, front of neck airway. And even in their own guidelines, the Difficult Airway Society interchangeably use emergency front of neck airway and front of neck airway. Now, again, a tracheostomy over 35 minutes is a front of neck airway, but it's not an emergency front of neck airway. So again, neck rescue, a lot of, it sounds like a casual term, but it's a lot of thought went into it. It can't be shortened. The emergency neck airway, by saying rescue, emergency is implicit to it. Mm-hmm. So that's it. You start talking about, people understand it, people know it's time critical, and people can't say that a surgical tracheostomy over 35 minutes is neck rescue. It's clearly not rescue. That's a surgical procedure. So that's I think I've gone way off track from whatever question you asked, but there you go.
Okay. So let me just teach back to you the general model here, and you tell me if I had this more or less right. The vortex is a funnel, and if you've entered the funnel, you are in a fundamentally unstable situation. You are being sort of dragged down, and there are only two ways you can go. You can get back out the top, which you can do by one of three means, either intubation or some supraglottic airway or mask ventilation. And as you kind of swirl through this airway, you may, you know, try any and all of these. It should be your very best attempt at one of those before you abandon it, and probably multiple attempts, and you sort of suggest probably no more than three because that's a common number, but that's sort of a loose concept. And then if you've done your very best, then you don't perseverate on that. You have two other options. If you can get back out the top, then you're not maybe in a globally stable situation. For example, a critically ill patient still might need ventilatory support or something, but you're in a place where you can take pause and think about the safest next step because the patient is oxygenating and is not dying. If you cannot get at the top by any of those means, then the only way out is the bottom, which is neck rescue. So there's kind of only those two options, and there's always this force dragging you down because, again, while you're in it, it's a dynamic, unstable situation. You can't pause and think because you have a patient who cannot oxygenate. Is that sort of the general scheme?
That is. Correct. One thing is that getting out into the green zone doesn't necessarily mean going out the top. If you look, there are some graphics on the side that show the vortex from the side, a sort of three-dimensional view. And the green zone is depicted as concentric rings outside the blue funnel of the vortex. And the important part of that is that, so you don't move up to the top, you just move out to the side, out of the funnel, into the green zone. And the idea is that the being in the vortex or the situation, the blue funnel, the point where you can't establish alveolar ventilation, that steep slope there is intended to convey that, you know, this is a, as you say, an unstable situation. You need to move efficiently and you need to do whatever you can to get into the green zone. Conversely, the green zone is depicted as a series of horizontal rings, so that to impart the idea that there's stability there, that because it's not, you're not on that steep slope anymore, that's somewhere you can sit and stay. This is, again, part of this conceptual imprinting idea that without needing to think about this, you sort of see this steep slope, steep blue slope, which again sort of implies cyanosis and hypoxia, versus this green safe area where you can sit and stand. The reason it's important to realize you don't go out to the top is if you've had multiple attempts at face masks, supraglottic airway, tracheal tube, and you might have a couple more legitimate optimizations and some more attempts up your sleeve before you need to commit to neck rescue, and you get into the green zone with face mask ventilation at that point. Being in the green zone two-thirds of the way down the funnel is a very different situation from being in the green zone on your, you know, usually if we put a patient off to sleep, we have our first attempt laryngoscopy, that doesn't work, we face mask ventilate, that's fine. You're in the green zone, very high up in the funnel. You've got a whole world of options there to explore. But if you've had all those attempts already and now you enter the green zone way, way down, again, it's conceptually really important that people realize that's not the same situation, because we might have some things we can do to establish an airway, but, you know, we might have one or two more moves and then we're cutting the neck. And so it's important that people have that recognition that this is a different thing. So the green zone actually surrounds the blue funnel. It just doesn't sit at the rim at the top of it. I think for your listeners, probably this all sounds very complex and three-dimensional, but But it's really not, because if when you look at the graphics, what I find is, you know, all this sort of conceptual stuff, we're not expecting to use a three-dimensional cognitive aid. The cognitive aid is a simple circle, and we just talk about it like a funnel. And the thing is, once it's been explained to you that's what it is, it's very hard to unsee it. You don't really need to think about it, but all those additional conceptual sort of elements are sort of superimposed and they just become second nature. And the idea was that it was simple enough to be referred to, you know, to go to the simplicity of it, simple enough to be referred to in real time, rather than trying to read something. You know, your ability to process stuff in real time is and read things in a real emergency is really difficult, but it's much easier to look at it as a visual tool. But what I found is even one step beyond that is that we'll... you know, I get a lot of emails from people who've used it in real crises, and they say, in my mind's eye, I could just see we were down in the center of the vortex, that eventually you don't need the physical tool. It's so simple that they just see that image in their mind and it prompts them. And I think, you know, I don't know the science behind this, but I think if you try to recall a written tool in your mind, you can imagine, I can see that writing on it in my mind. You're not really seeing the writing. You're remembering what it is, and you're writing it in there for yourself. But when you remember an image, you are just remembering the image. And I think by calling this up in their mind, that they can see where those things are. There's on the right side of the vortex tool, next to the circle, there is a list of five categories of optimization that might help you succeed with any of the three upper airway lifelines. And they are manipulations, adjuncts, changing the size and type of something, suction, and muscle tone. And so they're the broad things you can, categories of things you can alter to optimize your attempts at any of those three things. And the specific interventions under those headings will vary depending which lifeline you're dealing with. When I first released the Vortex, those things used to just be listed in text there. And when I would present it, I would never say what they were. I would talk about the five headings, but I would never list them during my presentation, because I was always worried that whilst I was trying to present something that was so simple, I would get one of them wrong and demonstrate that when I'm, you know, stressed from presenting, I can't remember them. And then I, as I sort of realized the utility of the sort of visual prompt, I came up with an icon for each of those five headings and I put them there. And since then, I've always presented them, because I've realized, again, I see those headings in my mind's eye. And I can recall them because I don't have to remember what they are. I can see the five icons and say them. So, whether it's anxiety from presenting or it's the stress of an airway crisis, it to me, it just demonstrated the utility of a visual prompt over a written prompt is much easier for you to access in the stress of an emergency.
Now, let me ask you, when do you enter the vortex? Because in my context in the ICU, I immediately think of that happens when usually we're doing an RSI, and when we sedate and paralyze the patient, that's when we're in it. And I'm sure that many cases that is true. But I can think of corner cases where I don't know how much it applies. For example, if someone is doing an awake intubation, are they never really there because the patient is breathing the entire time? Or conversely, maybe we induce the patient and if maybe there's an option of reversing their paralysis and letting them breathe again. Is that also a way we could kind of escape the vortex here?
Yeah, so it comes back to the definition of the vortex. So the vortex is the situation where you can confirm adequate alveolar oxygen delivery. And as I said, it's adequate. It's not necessarily normal. It's a saturation that will not harm the patient if you were to stay there for in the short term. So, you know, if the sats are 80% for 15 minutes, that's not going to hurt most patients. And there's a bit of a hysteresis associated with what you think is adequate. It's, you know, a lot of people will sort of say, oh no, the sats are 80, we need to get them up, and they'll have a fiddle and do something, lose the airway, and suddenly the sats are 40. And then you think, remember that time when we had sats of 80? Those were the days. So I think it's really important that you think, is this adequate? Is the patient in a position of relative safety? And then the confirmation of alveolar ventilation comes from, you know, the gold standard is a sustained capnography trace. But also in a situation, I'm not suggesting you replace, but it's replace capnography with this, but in a situation where you didn't have access to capnography for some reason, a rising saturation also confirms the alveolar ventilation. Conversely, a sustained high saturation doesn't confirm it, because the whole reason we pre-oxygenate patients is so that if we are stuck in the vortex, the oxygen saturations will be maintained. So, you know, pre-oxygenating the patient to the sats being 98 and them staying 98, that doesn't tell you anything about whether you're currently delivering oxygen to the alveoli. But a rising sat does. So confirmed is CO2, or if you don't have access to that, a rising sat. And adequate is just a sat that you think won't harm the patient. The important thing about that is it's a binary situation. Everyone is either in the green zone or either in the vortex. There is no, we're sort of in the green zone. You've got to decide, because the actions you would undertake there's a clear fork in the road in what you would do. If you're in the vortex, if you decide you're in the vortex, you know, you might be getting CO2, but the sats are 40, it's not adequate. You might be ventilating a little bit, but it's not enough. You've got to do something. If you're in the vortex, you've got to do something to establish a better airway. If you're in the green zone, you have the opportunity to stop and think. So you've got to very clearly define between those two options. As you say, we're all in the green zone now. You know, before you induce your patient, before you push your induction agents and your muscle relaxants, people are in the green zone. So when you're doing your awake intubation, so there are a whole lot of green zone techniques. And so I refer to the way you can manage the airway as that you can maintain the, and this comes to what are your options in the green zone. Your options are to maintain the airway that's got you in the green zone in the first place, convert the airway to a different airway while trying to stay in the green zone the whole time, or replace the airway, which means I'm going to step into the vortex with the expectation that I can get back into the green zone with a different lifeline. So maintain is essentially doing nothing. And this comes up, convert is, you know, from someone who you're initiating airway management, an awake intubation is a conversion procedure. Your intention is never to be in the vortex. That's the whole reason you're doing it. They're in the green zone. I'm going to put the tracheal tube in awake, and then I'll be in the green zone with the tube, and then I'll go off to sleep. And there's no point where we're expecting to be in the vortex. You still have to make preparations for the contingency that you inadvertently end up in the vortex. But your plan is to stay in the green zone, and you've got a strategy that will address that. That's conversion. Replacement is what we usually do. You know, we usually say, okay, I'm going to position them. I've got them all ready. Now I'm going to give them their propofol and their rocuronium, and they're going to become apneic and potentially obstruct their airway. We're going to go into the vortex. But my expectation is that then when I put laryngoscope in, put the tube in, we'll be back in the green zone. So you're replacing their native airway with the tracheal tube. That's the convert. That's the replacement. But there's a period of airway loss that is either inevitable or acknowledged to be highly likely in that situation.
So and that's, I see the value that's where, of making it binary, that what they're doing is adequate or not, because, you know, most of our ICU patients probably are in the green zone. They're just in a more subacute way. They need some more support. A small number are actually in respiratory failure, and they're already in the vortex before we touch them. And it's probably a dynamic thing, too. You know, most cardiac arrests, for instance, we're tolerant of very little alveolar ventilation. We think that's adequate. So we may be able to achieve that during the arrest without much trouble, but then they get a pulse back, and now maybe our standards for what's adequate are much higher. And then now,
yeah, well, that's the reason people have often asked me why I don't give a number for what's adequate. And the reason is exactly that. You know, if someone, you know, I would say in general for most patients, more than 80 is probably fine. Below that, it's a very low sat, and also I don't know the accuracy with which the oximeters are picking it, pulse oximeters are picking that up. But the if you look back at the, you know, you could conceivably have a patient that comes in, you know, in respiratory failure with sats of 65 on 100% oxygen, and that's as good as they get. And they're awake and they're breathing, but their sats are 65. That must be the green zone because, you know, otherwise they would die. It's not desirable, it's not nice, but it's adequate for them at that time. It needs to be addressed, but it's adequate. Because if their sats are 65 on 100% oxygen, then if you say that they must have sats of 80%, then they can never be in the green zone because you might put the tube in and only still get back to that sats of 65 while you're trying to recruit and give your PEEP and whatnot. You've got to set yourself a level of adequacy that relates to that patient. So as you say, it's relative to the situation. So that's why it's got to be adequate rather than absolute number. And you've got to decide what's adequate for that patient. One more thing about, you know, I think we talked about being in the green zone and converting the airway from the outset when you're initiating airway management. But also during that process, you know, you might put the patient off to sleep. You can't intubate them. You can't face mask ventilate them. You put a supraglottic airway in and you rescue the airway and get into the green zone that way. Again, maintain, convert, replace. Do I just use the supraglottic airway? You know, there are situations in anesthesia where, you know, if it's a time-critical cesarean section, we might just say, let's go ahead. This is not a protected airway. It's not ideal, but this needs to be done. We're going to maintain the airway with the supraglottic airway and we're just going to do the case on the supraglottic airway. In critical care, that's not an option. So you've got to move to a tracheal tube. So your options are to, you know, convert that airway to a tracheal tube by putting a fiberscope down and intubating through the tracheal tube. That would be conversion. Again, the intention to maintain ventilation throughout that process versus replacing would be pulling the supraglottic airway out and saying, now I'm going to have a go with the hyperangulated blade, which we haven't used yet, but you're risking going back into the vortex. And as a general principle, I would say if you've gotten into the green zone with a lifeline in an airway that's proven itself to be difficult, you need to have a bloody good reason to step out of the green zone back into the vortex deliberately. You really want to be aiming for conversion rather than replacement in that setting. And then the other thing you mentioned, the idea of sort of backing out of airway management of can I reverse them and maybe wake them up in some settings, which is, you know, predominantly a setting in something in the setting of an anesthesiologist practice rather than emergency or intensive care, but for short periods it may still be an option in those patients as well. I think this is where there's sort of recognition of the different opportunities that are available in the green zone and the vortex is really important. And what I teach is that there are two mistakes you can make with respect to sort of reversing the patient and trying to wake them up. The first is not considering doing that when you're in the green zone. I think it's probably, and I say consider, not do, I think it's probably more often than not impractical, but I think you should think about it. There are certainly airway disasters that would have been averted by taking that course. So not considering waking the patient in the green zone is an error, but considering waking the patient when you're not in the green zone is an error. So if you haven't been able to get into the green zone through face mask, supraglottic airway, intubation, whatever, you can't suddenly say, let's just wake them up, because you don't know the time involved. You can reverse a neuromuscular blocking agent if you've got used the right one. If you've used ROC, you can reverse that. You can reverse benzodiazepines. You can reverse opioids. There is no induction agent we know how to reverse, and you can't reverse whatever underlying impairment of conscious state the patient may have had that may have actually contributed to needing airway management in the first place. But even in a well patient, you don't know how long it's going to be between reversing that ROC uranium and all those other things wearing off, you know, just their propofol wearing off, and when they're going to breathe. So what your management ends up being is, I'm going to stand there and wait and hope the patient sorts this out. And that's not really an acceptable option. So, you know, what I teach is that waking the patient is a green zone option. If you're in the green zone where you've got time to wait for things, propofol to wear off, then that might be a great idea. But if you're stuck in the vortex and you can't get out and the patient is hypoxic you can't just give them muscle relaxation, reverse their muscle relaxation and wait for them to wake up. What you've got to do is take active steps to establish airway patency and alveolar ventilation. And again, where the simplicity of the vortex becomes useful is that often when you're teaching that, that's a revelation to people to contextualize where that option fits, because it's often just dropped at the end. And the other thing is think about waking the patient. But there are situations where that's valid and there are situations where that's contraindicated. And it also allows a team to say to someone who says, oh, we'll try and wake them up, to say, no, we're not in the green zone. Waking is a green zone option. So that's not one of our options at the moment because we're in the vortex. And it makes that, you know, that real-time crisis mode thinking sort of simple and clear. It gives a clarity to the communication, and it sort of categorizes your options in a way that makes it easy to plan your strategy from there.
I'm fascinated. Brian, what other questions do we have?
Well, not a question so much as just an observation. First, I love this whole approach. Recently, we were talking with Scott Weingart about running codes, and it sort of caused a little bit of controversy online when we talked about sort of quote unquote deviating from ACLS. And, you know, his point was ACLS is fine, but, you know, you can't be stuck in a rigid algorithm. And I think that's kind of what this is saying, right, is that the difficult airway algorithm, the ASA and the Difficult Airway Society algorithms are both fine, right? But you can't be stuck in a rigid algorithm and adapt, you know. And you mentioned simulation, and I did a lot of simulation, write a lot of scenarios. And anybody who's ever written a simulation scenario can, I think, relate to this, because you write – you know, you write this scenario that's like step one is how it starts, and then step two is what's going to happen. And you know good and well, we're never step two, three, four, five, we're never doing those, right? That is folly. That is something that I write down so my SimOps can have something to program into the mannequin, but it's not really going to happen, you know. And there's a famous general who has this quote, no plan survives first contact with the enemy. And I think about that all the time with things like this, because real life just doesn't work that way, right? You know, the patient didn't read the ACLS algorithm. They didn't read the Difficult Airway Society algorithm. They're not playing right. And you can't make them, right? You can't say you're not following the algorithm. And so I like this idea of being able to say, we have the algorithm as a guide, but we're not going to be married to it.
Well, it's about goals, so it's like, how do you achieve those goals? And they're not really disputable. I mean, no one can argue that your goal is to, like, oxygenate a patient. So.
Yeah, I think that's exactly – it's funny. When the Vortex was first released, the emergency physicians, the intensivists, were very quick to adopt it, and it was the anesthesiologists who were resistant. And a lot of the resistance came from, you've dumbed down airway management too much, is what people would say to me. And I said, but I haven't. What I've done is accept you have the expertise to know when the algorithm applies and what you should do in that specific context. The dumbing down is telling you step by step that you must do it in this order. I'm saying you're the expert. These are the goals. I'm just reminding you of the goals and saying you use your expertise to decide how best to achieve them in that specific context. So it really is, as you say, Brian, it's about prompting you to make sure you keep your eye on the prize, but saying, you know, you've got the expertise to decide how to do that within certain boundaries. It's not anything goes, but, you know, you don't need to be married to a rigid stepwise approach to this, because it might not apply. As you say with the simulation thing, I don't know if you've ever done this, but we at times run a scenario where nothing happens. And, you know, people create their own emergency. You can have something.
All right, Nick. I'm just fascinated by all this. Parting thoughts. What do you want people to remember going forth? I do hope everyone looks at the graphic, spends some time on your site, because this is all heavily thought out, and you have a lot of resources for them.
It's a great site, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this really is very utilizable stuff. It's not like people need to go do a certification course in the Vortex or anything. I think they could all apply it more or less right now. But what do you want people to go away from this podcast knowing?
I think what I would like them is to take away the importance of having a structured, team-based approach to emergency airway management. That we, you know, this isn't about making mistakes because you're not skilled or not knowledgeable. It's about being a human being, and that under pressure, mistakes get made. And the solution to avoiding those things is by having a structured approach that the whole team can keep track of. And as I said, it doesn't matter what your underlying specific way of doing it is, whether it's a particular algorithm or something you've developed yourself or something at your institution. What the Vortex does is it sort of unifies all those approaches by whatever approach the NWA operator is using, everyone else can track what they have and haven't done using the Vortex model. And therefore, you know, I often tell people one of the strengths of the Vortex is if everything goes fine, it doesn't even need to get mentioned. You know, the person puts off their patient to sleep, they get into the Vortex, they do what they do, and they, you know, even if it doesn't go all completely straightforward, if they're moving forward in a productive manner, you don't need to get into it. Where the Vortex comes into play is that during those attempts, everyone else can watch and keep track of what has and hasn't been done and use that model to sort of track what still needs to be done. And the only reason it comes up is if the operator sort of either asks for prompts, or you can see that they're starting to do the same thing over and over again, or that you can see they're getting to their second and third attempt at things and there are crucial things they haven't done yet, then the team can sort of step in. So I think the real thing to take away is that, you know, disasters, I'm not saying don't be skilled. It's very important to be skilled, but disasters happen to good people and they happen because of these sort of things. And so you've got to recognize that you, in addition to having the technical skills and the cognitive skills to make the right decision, you've got to have a way to implement that in real time. Knowing how to do it doesn't mean you'll implement it in real time. And that's really what the Vortex is about, is giving your technical skills and decision-making skills the best opportunity to manifest in real time during an emergency.
All right. Well, we'll let you go. Just a reminder to everyone, this is just some general educational content, no specific advice for you. And we're just sharing our own thoughts on this, not representing any particular organizations or societies. And we'll talk to you next time.